Dr. Rock's radio show. Thursday, 8 p.m. on peoplesinternetradio.com. We go to 11.
Rolling Stones there and 19th Nervous Breakdown. It's amazing we managed to keep it just 19, isn't it, really, looking out at the world. Anyway, I'm joined tonight. I'm really happy to say that I've got Gregory Sams on the line. Gregory, can you still hear me?
I sure can, Dr. Rock.
Absolutely great. Thanks very much for joining us again. It's been a few years since we talked with you last.
It has. Good years.
Yeah, indeed. So I've seen you... described as a cultural change agent, macrobiotic gangster, grocer and author, which sounds like a very interesting history.
Now that just scratches the surface.
I'll bet it does. Do you want to tell us a little bit about how it is you came to be where you are and, you know, what life was like for the young Greg?
Oh, God, life has been full of changes and new vistas to explore since I was, 17 years old, I guess. I'm not sure where to start, but I could start with my dad nearly dying before I was born, back in 1947, I think it was, and somebody recommended him to a wacky Japanese doctor in Los Angeles because the Western doctors had given up on him. He'd lost half his weight, his skin was turning black, nobody knew what was wrong, and this Japanese doctor put him on what we call a natural food diet. There was nothing specifically organic in those days, but, you know, there was no processed foods, which means no tins or no frozen food, whole cereals, beans, vegetables, fish. I had to cut out meat, cut out sugar, and I could go into details of the diet, but my dad healed really quickly. He got better again, and thereafter, my mother baked her own bread, restricted our sugar intake, so we were brought up, my brother and I, on a really healthy diet. So when we discovered microbiotics, which was the sort of first entry to organic natural eating on the planet, it made sense to us. We started eating the food because we hadn't been indoctrinated by our parents, but we'd been biologically conditioned, if you like.
Yeah.
So when we discovered that, we said, hey, this is really good. And I could, speaking for myself, immediately notice the difference in how I thought, how my energy was. You know, it was, wow, this is really great. I'm not getting depressed and energy dropouts and stuff like that.
That must have been pretty unusual in those days, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, I'd become vegetarian when I was 10 just because I didn't like the taste of red meat. And I thought, well, I'll give up sausages if that means they don't have to eat the rest of it. Yeah, throughout my upbringing, I never met another vegetarian in school. I mean, I was the only one in the class.
Right.
But then when I got into the concept of macrobiotics when I was 16, my brother introduced me to it. He brought it back from university. And that was a diet which was based on what I did eat instead of what I didn't eat. And I thought, hey, this is a whole new tack. You know, I've got something that I do eat. But there was nothing around. We opened a restaurant up in 67 called Seed, and it was the seed of natural foods in this country. And that was the only place you could eat brown rice or buckwheat or seaweeds or miso.
Was that in London then?
That was in London, in a basement in Paddington off the beaten track.
And way back in 67.
That's right. And we appealed to the... We were hippies, so it was like the only eating place for that subculture in the UK at that time. And, you know, John and Yoko used to come down, Mark Bolan used to come down. I mean, it was the only, and penniless hippies who would come down for our free meals. So it was quite a nexus, but people wanted to eat that food at home. So I went and opened up a shop where you could buy these weird things. Because in a health food shop, you couldn't buy food. You could buy whole wheat flour, oats, and kidney beans. Those were about the only foodstuffs. Everything else, pills and potions and herbs.
Yeah, yeah. When you'd actually one of Dr. Rock's kitchen posse is a man called Van the Man who deals in Whole Foods. And he knew you all those years ago.
I remember Van the Man. He had a shop in... In Wales.
That's right, he still does.
He still does. He's a great guy. I love that stuff. I dropped in on him years ago when I was passing through.
Yeah, he asked me to send you his greetings. He did. He was really pleased to hear you were coming on.
Send him my love as well.
Yeah, I'll do that.
I'm pleased to hear he's still at it.
committed. He is absolutely committed. And, you know, the next nearest one's probably 40 miles away. So we're all very grateful to him around here.
Yeah. Well, that was one of the shops. I mean, it was other shops, other people wanted to sell the foods that we had at Ceres Grain Shop. So that got into wholesaling, manufacturing, distribution, all of that. And that ended up with a really large company, a little bit of a nightmare trying to keep it going. You know, I'm good at running things from the seat of the pants, but that was quite complex.
It sounds like a pretty rapidly expanding and successful operation that does. It must have been actually doing it by the seat of your pants, I would imagine.
Well, it was successful from the point of view of, you know, hundreds of tons of food were going out. But it was losing money because margins are really tight in the food business. You know, you don't double the prices. You just put them up 30% or even less times. So you're trying to work within a 1% or 2% profit margin. This is all boring, really, isn't it? Mm-hmm. But it's really tight. So anyway, I left that. My ticket out of that was Veggie Burger. I created the first ever Veggie Burger, and I came up with a name for it. Which was an unfamiliar name. It sounded strange at the time. I was also considering calling it a green burger and a plant burger and an earth burger, which would be a good one.
no, possibly not.
So that went. I ran that for six or seven years. It got really big. It took off, and it was the first time I actually made money on that, which was very satisfying, I've got to say.
I suppose you're adding value, aren't you, by creating a veggie burger out of the raw materials? You're adding value, aren't you? You're doing a bit of processing, which always, that's where the money is, really.
That's where the money is, but there was also no competition, because as soon as people got used to brown rice and chickpeas and sesame seeds, there's always somebody who can put a, you know, pound of sesame seeds in a bag for less than an old hippie.
Yeah.
A veggie burger, I had a trademark on the name, and I kept my recipe secret so nobody knew what it was. So that was really the secret. And it was cheap. I mean, it wasn't an expensive product, but that did well. When I left that, I sold that off, and that was my ticket out of the food industry. I had a couple of years of advanced installment on my retirement. And then I discovered chaos theory.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, I've got that. Yes.
It was a brand new thing then. Nobody'd seen fractals, and nobody recognized how things self-organize, whether it's a weather system or a rainforest or most aspects of human society. You know, we end up with order and harmony and a structure without somebody saying in advance, this is how we're going to join up the dots, this is how we're going to manage this. It just comes out of the mix of, you know, unquantifiable number of components in the system, whether that's people or whether that's, you know, raindrops and weather and pressure. But those components self-organize into some sort of harmonious structure. And there's a whole science developed around that. It was really exciting because it was something scientists had never studied before. And I realized scientists wouldn't apply this to sociology, because sociology is a dirty word to scientists, you know, not a hard science, which is why I opened the shop dedicated to chaos theory, because I thought, well, people have got to realize we self-organize, and we do it better than having a government organize us from the top down.
It was a pretty pretty critical discovery for you, wasn't it?
It was. I had already had lessons in the power of freedom, and how important it was, and how dangerous and awful coercion was as a means of getting people to do stuff. You know, do this or I'm going to damage you somehow, whether that's fine you or put you in jail or give you 50 lashes. It's not a way to achieve social order and harmony. But chaos theory, it was like the science that underpinned this. And that, and opening the shop, and going to some wild, some of the first parties and festivals in the early 90s, where I saw all of this stuff in practice, people self-organizing and having safe parties that were really fun parties with no controls or you know, top-down management. So that led me to write my first book, The State is Out of Date, which was then had a separate title in 98, Uncommon Sense, this date is out of date. But that was the book that put all this together and showed us how we could actually do a better job than the government.
So the discovery of chaos theory effectively made you, I guess, re-examine your knowledge of how everything was working.
Well, it was one of those things, you know, you've got a lot of important strings in your life, threads you follow. And when I discovered chaos theory, it was like bound all those threads into a nice bit of cable that really, you know, brought it together and made a lot more sense. And that was that. And that's, we can talk about that book, because it was after that I went on and, you know, started looking into the sun and about the sun, and that led to my next book.
It is all kind of tied together by the chaos theory, as we're going to find out, isn't it? That's the kind of constant strand that runs through two otherwise highly different-sounding books.
It does to a degree, yeah.
And also, I mean, the end of The Son of God, you're drawing together quite a lot of the links. I think the two things together are... It's very interesting, really, to see the spiritual and the temporal, if you like, placed
exactly
one immediately after the other.
Took the words out of my mouth, yeah. I mean, as I put it, Son of God, which for your listeners, that's S-U-N of God.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no capital G on God. It's not the biblical God we're talking about here. That really did for organized religions what the state is out of date does for the organized states that are screwing our world up.
So my conclusion about the two books when I read them is that they're both actually a lot more reasonably put and humorously put than a lot of the material we might come across nowadays on YouTube and the like. And they are thus actually, I think, extremely good introductory books to lend to people who may be approaching the rabbit hole but haven't yet realized what it is they're looking at.
Yeah, that's true. It's it is kind of amusing. If you detach yourself from the emotional side of it, it's amusing how fucked up we are.
I think the emotional point is an important one, because if we, as long as it's going on as it is and we're doing the best we can and not attaching any emotional charge to the things that we're hearing, it's a lot easier for us to make our own progress, I think.
Yeah, it's also, you know, the state is out of date. It stops you banging your head. There's this confusion. Why would governments do this? Why would they do something so crazy? It's obviously, you know, the wrong move. Whether that's like just single example, biofuels, you know, that take more energy. Most of them take more energy to produce than the fuel that they're replacing, and they drive indigenous people off their land. And you look at that and you say, why? Why are they doing that? But when you understand the nature of coercion and the way that operates in government, you can see that's the sort of stuff we're going to get. And as long as we expect the state to solve important problems, they're going to come up with the wrong solutions, even when they've got the right intentions.
Yes. Yeah, and even when they do actually implement the solutions that they propose, which isn't always the case.
Yeah, I mean, they often make promises and don't keep up to them. And their solutions, they quite often have a very different effect from that was intended, because they're not doing it in the right way.
Yeah, or at least from the apparent intention. I was watching a White Rabbit Trust video this morning, and Simon Spaniard was showing us a small piece of card he had with a number of bits of stone on it, and he said this represents all the countries of the EC who are bankrupt, and they back the EC. The EC, because there's not enough cash in any of the countries that back it up, they're going to sell some bonds, he says. They're going to sell some IOUs, which will allow them to release currency, apparently, into the system. And they justify their ability to release currency into the system by saying that they're backed up by all the countries which are, of course, bankrupt and have no money. And then the real kicker is that, of course, all that money has to be then paid back with interest attached, and that's done because we work and pay it over in our tax. So I guess we might as well start with the money in the banks, because it's at the basis of it all, isn't it, really?
Well, not really. I mean, we don't have to pay it back, because our children and grandchildren will be paying it back.
Fair point. Yeah.
Yeah, okay, let's start with the banks. What do you want to...
Well, the thing is, it's all kind of tied together, isn't it? When we look at the 20 or 30-odd chapters in The State is Out of Date,
yeah,
quite a lot of it boils down to the money and the banks and how they relate to the government, who, as you've said, don't appear necessarily to be coming up with the right solutions. And it's possible you could be forgiven for thinking, can't you, that they're coming up with the right solutions for themselves, because the money and the banks and the government seem to work pretty closely together.
Well, let me look for quotes here. But the governments have had, you know, real money. There's nothing sort of you can have real money and an oppressive, nasty government system all at the same time.
Yeah.
But the banks have done a good job of taking over the money supply, and thus having a real handle on the governments in terms of what they're doing. And I'm just looking for this quote from the Rothschild, Mayor Rothschild.
Oh, yes, that
he says, "Give me control of a nation's money supply, and I care not who makes the laws." Because once you've got control of the money supply, you've got a nation by the balls. And it's a license to print money, as I think most of us know. The fiat currencies we have now have no intrinsic value whatsoever. The only value they have is the value that we imbue in them. And as governments print new money, we have inflation. I mean, inflation is a horrendous thing. And the thought that they have a target inflation, that they want to have an inflation at, whether it's 1% or 2%, there's no need for any inflation. And for centuries going up from the 15th and 16th century up to the 18th, parts of the 19th century even, the price of bread and beer would go up and down, but it was pretty much stable. It wasn't this inevitable thing that something cost more 10 years later than it did 10 years ago. That's this crazy concept we have.
I see, that came as a surprise to me, when even with a bit of a history of economics and all the rest of it, I was surprised to find that, broadly speaking, you could get the same amount of beer and bread with your American dollar in the 1920s as you could have got, or in the, say, the 1910s, as you could have got in the 1810s.
That's right.
Yeah. We're so used to it, aren't we?
Because if money is real, whether it's a dollar bill represents a certain amount of gold, or, you know, a certain amount of a cow, you know, or measure of grain, whatever you base that currency on, you know, there's no reason that in 100 years, an ounce of silver should be worth, you know, 20 loaves of bread instead of 10 loaves of bread.
Which is where we've got to, but it's a bit, the realization for me that followed on from that was that at some point my £20 note printed for pennies by the private corporations would have actually been exchangeable for £20 weight of sterling silver.
Sterling silver. Yeah. Not many people know what it means even.
No, whereas nowadays you'd be lucky in London to get 4 packets of crisps.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I used to collect coins and British coinage up to, I think it was 1950-something, used to have an element of silver in it. But while I was collecting coins, it soon reached the point where the old coins were worth much more than their face value because of the silver content. But the most iniquitous thing about banks and the money supply is that they make a point of not fighting with each other. So you don't have a conflict between the different banking dynasties, not the one that we're aware of anyway. So it's conflict that gets our attention. But because they're just sort of old, they're doing it in the background, there's that. And there's also the other key factor, it's boring and impenetrable.
Yeah.
To try and figure out what the heck is going on. And people don't like stuff that's boring and impenetrable, so they get away with literal murder. Mm-hmm. And they engineer financial collapses where suddenly all the value of our money is lost, transferred to them. With the money that they're printing, they can then buy up hard assets, like when you buy a coal mine or an oil well or a steel producing factory, things like that. They have an intrinsic value that doesn't go down with inflation. And it's this really insidious process going on. And it's a fascinating fact that not many people know about. I mean, do you know what the most stable commodity in the world has been for the last 20 years?
Ooh, houses?
No, currency.
Currencies. The most stable currency.
Over 20 years. It's the Somali shilling.
Oh, fucking, I'd never have guessed that.
It's the Somali shilling, because they haven't had a functioning government there for 20 years.
Absolutely, so they're brilliant.
They're still recycling the same old money.
Yeah.
And it's paper, it's complete fiat currency, it has no intrinsic value, but it's not being manipulated by banks, the government, and printed willy-nilly. So it gained 50% against the dollar in the last couple of years.
That's astonishing, though completely understandable, I guess. And I mean, the other thing is that it's my understanding that there is actually a link between inflation, income tax, and interest. That one of the reasons why we ended up seeing, one of the reasons why we ended up seeing inflation was because of the interest on the loans, and we got income tax in order to pay that. So the three things are kind of sort of enmeshed, if you like. And obviously, I shouldn't think in Somalia there's actually the capacity to collect tax.
No. They tried to set up a central bank, but people wouldn't have anything of it a few years back. We don't get the figures on how much of our tax, or maybe they're in there somewhere, how much of our tax is going to pay loans, interest on loans from banks for money they create from nothing. It's really a sinister thing that's going on, and you can see why it's very hard to do anything about it, because banks print the money that pays politicians. The rest of us, you know, this is something I put forward sometimes. We have this fear of the international banking collapse. It nearly happened in 2008. As we know, people at the negotiating table were phoning their wives and saying, go to the ATM machine, get out all the money you can now, because you ain't going to be able to do it tomorrow. It was that close. And that's been kicked downstream, and the situation hasn't been fixed. And at some point, that may well come to fruition. It may, or dissolution. And if that happens, I actually think that humanity and business will be able to recover within a period of months or a year or two. It's like when you actually look at what we're doing, whether you're growing wheat, whether you're running a supermarket and selling that whole range of products, whether you're making iPhones, or whether you're building container ships to transport those iPhones from China to America and Europe. All the materials to do that, whether it's the sun and air and water to produce wheat, or whether it's the rare earth metals and materials that go and ingenuity that go into smartphones, that's all still there. That's all in place. Everything you need to build a container ship is in place. And those things aren't built by governments. They're not built by the international financial system. They're built by people and the people that make up corporations. So what would happen in that? I think that businesses would figure a way around this very quickly, because their lives, their incomes depend upon it. And when you look at all the effort and coordination between different companies that goes into building a container ship, how much coordination is needed to sort of exchange those values of what stuff is worth? Because the relative value of apples and tennis balls is not determined by the financial system. That's a real relationship between those two things. And how you express that, there are loads of ways of doing that. And I really think we could figure that out, even if those banks collapsed. How the governments would run is another question, because how do they figure out some means to get us to pay them in order to make rules about what sort of drugs we can take, or what the minimum standards are for a house, or all the other things that they manage aren't really barter type of things. And I can paint a picture of a much better world after that system collapses.
I think we have had better systems in the past, haven't we? I mean, I've been reading about tally sticks. That's an amazing way of actually running your currency in exchange, because it seems to be a pretty much a direct exchange between one individual and another, and the banks at that stage were only peripherally involved.
Tally sticks, tell me more.
Basically, the idea was that you'd have a kind of stick on which would be marked all of the things that you bought, say when you were at market, and on the other side of the tally stick would be all the things that you'd been sold. And these two sticks were designed in such a way as they would actually fit together, so that you could have some kind of reckoning on the credit and debit of the system.
Mm-hmm.
And I gather that one of the shareholders in the Bank of England actually bought his shares with tally sticks.
Right. Wow.
And of course they probably still are shareholders. So the people who exchanged a couple of ingenious sticks for shares in the Bank of England, a private corporation printing money and then lending at interest to the government, actually only had to pay for it with the old system, which was a simple credit debit system marked on a pair of sticks.
Right. I mean, that's an example of how ingenious human beings are, how successfully we rise to the challenge of meeting our own needs. And that's, we do that all over the place. And you see that happening incredibly well on the World Wide Web, when people set up things like Uber and Airbnb, saying, hey, there's a need here. How can we supply this in a better way? And this huge need, how do we replace the international financial system? These sort of greedy bankers, you've got nations by the short and curlies. When they collapse into their own weight, and I have no doubt that humanity and corporations and small businesses and big businesses will be able to rise to that challenge. There was actually a banking strike in Ireland, which I recall it was the very early 70s, and it went on for 6 months or more. And things went on very much as normal. People lived without the banks. And that was before all the technology and connectivity that we have today.
It certainly wouldn't be difficult to imagine a system that works better for the people than the one we've got at the moment.
It's not a question of imagining it. People tend to think, well, we've got to imagine it. We've got to have this idea of what it's going to be. And what I point out in my book, and through the agency of chaos theory and the examples of what we've done in the past, we don't necessarily need to know in advance what that's going to be. We will create it when the need arises, and we might fumble and change and chop and a little bit before we get it right. But I have no doubt that we can get it right, because there are just so many examples of where we have done that in the history of humanity.
There's more examples of where we've done that than examples of where government is successful, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, can you show me a government that has been going on for the last 2,000 years? You know, there are none. Society has been going on. We're still baking bread. We still have transport. We communicate with each other. You know, all the things that people like, we're still doing that. Governments, none of them last. And in the height of the Roman Empire, I'm pretty sure they thought they would be the Roman Empire for the next, forever.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they had a handle on it. You know, how's that ever going to collapse? I mean, the Egyptians went for a couple thousand years. But when the Egyptian state collapsed, they didn't even, somehow they lost touch with their own language. You know, we had to wait till the 17th century and the discovery of the Rosetta Stone before we could read what was the hieroglyphs.
Yeah.
How could that happen? But when governments collapse, they take a lot down. They take a lot down with them.
It's an interesting theory, because I was reading recently in an archaeology magazine about the Maya, who are supposedly, they kind of reached that apogee, tremendously successful and complex society, and it was believed that they all just kind of disappeared somehow. But what it looks like now to people who are kind of working at the bottom end of it is that actually the power structure collapsed and people went back to living in grass huts and doing their artwork and doing whatever obeisance it was they needed to do in the home instead of in these huge temples. And I'm really hoping that they're going to continue on that work, because it sounds like an example of just what you're talking about.
Yeah, I'm not, I mean, there's a big debate still on what happened, but it does not appear that they were conquered by somebody.
No.
I don't know if climate change is a possible indicator. I'm aware of a couple of ancient civilizations that thrived without a nobility, without top-down control, which the Mayans did. The Mayans didn't have any sort of nobility, any sort of power structure for their first couple thousand years.
No, that's right.
And that developed in their last sort of 600 or 1100 years, they had that. Climate change is a tough one. I mean, if the climate changes, if it stopped raining in England for a few years, England, we wouldn't be here anymore.
It's resilience to that is something we definitely need to be thinking about, because that was a huge problem, not just for the Maya, but for lots of other peoples that arose around them, sort of lived for 300, or, you know, were organized for 300 years and then vanished again. It was mostly climate change that was doing that to them, or in the absence of climate change, what they seem to have experienced is vast population growth, forcing them to develop really, really very inventive ways of using the land and modifying their farming. But eventually that does get hit by climate change, and then you're in even more trouble than you were before. So they were incredibly creative for a very long period of time, much longer than anybody else around them.
That's right.
I think we probably are at the end of empire. We're in a position where America has military bases in 140 out of the 190 nominal countries on the planet. The governments, I mean, I tend to refer to them as singular because I don't see any difference between one and the next one. But the government of America has been able to do that as a result of the association between money and power, and the fact that it's kind of somehow indebted to the money suppliers and the owners of the mines. So now we seem to be in a position where, especially in America, I've been watching a little bit of the elections that are going on over there. We seem to be in a position where the banks and the money, the banks and the money and pretty much the mine interests, for, you know, are actually buying the government. I mean, is that a correct impression?
Somebody always seems to, you know, have a handle on the government. And at the moment, we see that happening with corporations, because corporations have gotten really much bigger over the last century, I suppose. Government, I mean, it's not a rather or not, but, you know, governments, they were all run, the Pope used to be the highest authority in Europe. So the Catholic Church had a major say in, they were, you know, the Pope was higher than any king or queen in Europe for centuries. We've had military juntas running countries in Greece and Argentina for a while, which was horrendous, you know, with just people disappearing, homosexuals being executed. You get, you know, really onerous people running governments. Mm-hmm. At the moment, you have corporations doing it, and they're using those levers of coercion. Because when you can coerce people into doing what you want, a lot of people are attracted to that particular power group. The same sort of people who want to be, Al Capone, gangsters. They have that capacity to force people to pay the money and do what they bid. And it's not the corporation. People say, oh, the corporations are the evil side of it. They're only evil in that they can direct governments to pass coercive legislation. So you have, you know, this terrible incursions upon indigenous people for mining and oil exploration. And it's always the governments, you know, the uniformed officers of the governments around the world who've issued those licenses to the corporations and who then go in and clear protesters and indigenous people from the land that they've sold rights to the corporations. And while the corporations might be willing to go in and shoot indigenous people themselves and forcibly clear them off the land, in today's social climate, they wouldn't get away with that. You know, there would be a public outcry like nothing you've ever seen. And they have done it in the past. The Ford Motor Company shot four of its workers in 1930-something. I mean, it's actually their own employees, security employees, shot and killed four strikers. And that was a horrendous uproar. at the time, you can't do that sort of thing. Mm. But when you're in the uniform of government, you can. And that's why they use governments to force people to vaccinate their children. I mean, what can you imagine the pharmaceutical companies having their employees going into schools and making you have your children vaccinated? No, you can't get close to doing that without the state behind you.
Although effectively, I guess that's what's going on, isn't it? Because the state's a corporation.
Well, the state is a coercive body. You know, it has the right to force people to do what they want. I mean, it was just last night, I happened to be watching an episode of House of Cards, and the, you know, where you've got the vice president and Raymond Tusk, who's this hugely wealthy industrialist, and they're fighting it off, and the vice president has beaten this sort of multi-billionaire in their sort of machinations, and he's saying to him, well, you might be the richest man in the world, but I've got men with guns working for me. Mm. And that's the ultimate dividing line. You've got people with guns doing your bidding legally. You know, that's more powerful than money.
Yeah. And effectively what that's telling us is that although we seem to live in a world where it's believed, generally speaking, that one shouldn't do unto others what one wouldn't want done to oneself, and where killing people is wrong, we do seem somehow, as a result of these things we're talking about, to be living in a world in which the people that cause harm, loss and damage are always getting away with it. And the people who aren't, the people, you know, who are committing, let's call them victimless crimes, are taking a whole lot of damage as a result. And I mean, I'm interested to think of the idea of the kind of impending collapse being a potential moment for changing everything. And it would seem to me that actually starting to live by the laws we've got rather than if we're going to have a government, having a government that would at least adhere to the laws we've got rather than ignoring them entirely might be a good step.
Yeah, there's a whole level of common law which developed, maritime law and so forth, developed before governments that we understand, and law that makes sense. And we have this sort of unending stream of apocalypse movies where people are running around shooting each other and looting, and there's this horrible, you know, left to our own without a government scenarios. But where we see governments collapsing, we see people or major sort of natural disasters creating a similar situation where all our services are gone. You see people pooling together, sharing things, working together to get through this. And it's a very kind of normal phenomenon that we experience. And Somalia is an example.
Yeah.
One of the other things that at one point, I don't know what the situation is now, but I remember reading about 10 years ago that it was, you could get a phone installed there quicker than any other country in Africa. Just things went smoothly there because people are good at it.
And also because, you know, government and the banks and all of that kind of stuff are kind of glue in the real wheels rather than grease. I was talking to a permaculturalist recently who was telling me that the Ugandans have worked out a way of moving credit around on their mobile phones. They've got the equivalent of a tally stick, but they use their mobile phone and the money never touches the bank. They go down the market, they get the credit put on their mobile phone, they can text it straight home and things like that, which is a brilliant idea.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's really fantastic. And with the technology of mobile phones and the World Wide Web, we have got this. We're more connected than at any time in the history of the world. We're more connected than small towns people were with each other. And we see the fruits of that connection coming up in so many beneficial ways that it really, and part of that is because it has not been highly regulated by the government. I mean, that's one of the reasons America, you're talking about the wealth of America and what it's gotten to. Part of the reason for that was it started off back in 1776 with a minimal level of government. One of the first president, George Washington, at one point, he was looking through the military budget, the Navy, and he's looking through and he sees this new anchor for one of the battleships. And he says, what's wrong with the old anchor? I mean, it was that level of minor government going on.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until the Civil War that it kind of got a bit nasty. And as this economy thrived and grew without regulation, there was more and more wealth for the government to suck out of it. and it's that made the government, you know, the strongest government in the, you know, the leading military aggressor in the world.
Mm.
But it was the strength of people and freedom that really helped get to that process.
Do you think it's still there, that drive for freedom in America? It seems that it is to me.
There's an aspect of that, and it's the one genetic consistency in all Americans. Everybody in America, not everybody, but just about everybody, their ancestors were willing to take a leap in the dark, saying, my God, it's so, you know, my ancestors came from Syria in the 1920s. They didn't know what was in America. My mother's ancestors came from Norway and Germany. And people got on a boat and traveled for months to an unknown land and just didn't know what they were going to do when they got there, but they sorted it out. They figured it out because they had this lust for freedom and this willingness to take risks and look after themselves. And some of those genes are still in Americans. And even though they might be fed genetically modified foods and given, you know, garbage news on the radio, they still have that intrinsic self-responsibility. And if somebody's doing well in America, they say, hey, I'm doing well, I'm making lots of money, or I'm doing, you know. Then in England, the most you can admit to is not bad.
Yeah. Yeah. So we find ourselves in a situation where effectively the banking dynasties, we'll call them, or mining dynasties, manipulated the market by rumouring that there was going to be a bank crash, which caused a lot of people to queue outside the smaller banks, so they did collapse, and they could be... the banking dynasties could buy them. Eventually, of course, you run out of banks and corporations to buy and interest to buy in your home country. So you're forced effectively to go stealing other people's, which I think is where the military industrial complex comes in, because you can then make sure that you take over other people's reserves and other people's banks, which might still be state controlled, and turn them into private banks. Plus, of course, the fact that the military industrial complex itself makes a lot of money, because you can destroy something far quicker than you can build it, and then you can send your people in. So the military-industrial complex is essentially the same as the banking money government system, isn't it? And it's just broadening its reach and its coercive power.
Well, they're very connected, and that's... I mean, they didn't used to be so connected, as Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, said. You know, people used to build munitions for wars. They would create, you know, even the First World War, armies would be created. When the wars were over, they'd be dissipated, and people would go back to their fields or their shops or whatever they were doing. That's how it was for a very long time. Okay, the Romans had standing armies, but most people built up an army to fight a war, and when the war was done, it would be disbanded. But Eisenhower was the one who pointed that out and warned that now the army isn't disbanding. We have this military-industrial complex. He warned Americans against it.
Yeah.
Very explicitly in his farewell address at the end of his presidency. It continued to grow. President Kennedy and JFK made the same warning again, very explicitly, but that was in the middle of his presidency, and some people say that was the speech that got him assassinated a few months later. There are various lots of reasons why he might have been assassinated. That's just one of them.
And that's a model we can see him working elsewhere, because I remember when I was a lad, my parents used to get checks back. They used to pay a check into the bank, and then it used to come back to them so that they could destroy it and throw it in the bin. Now, of course, they're kind of sold on. But in the old days, a population would have kind of arranged to build a bridge. They would have raised the necessary promissory notes to make it, then distributed the promissory notes as the bridge was made, such that when the job was actually done, the money was retired in much the same way as the army would have been retired in the old way of warfare.
Right.
It just started more. The more you learn about this stuff, it seems to me, the more you can see similarities and patterns in the techniques that are being used. They're incredibly versatile in the way they manage to move basic ideas into new fields.
There are lots of ways of doing things, and I'm always amazed that the railways and the canals and the London Underground transport system, tube system, were all built by corporations, by companies. They weren't government undertakings. Mm. People somehow raised enough money to build all those tunnels under London and get that transit going, and were willing to wait 10, 20 years to get some sort of a return on it.
Wasn't it true that even in those days, the corporations, because they were mostly associated specifically with towns and municipalities and things like that, isn't it true that they had the smack of government about them because they were all tied together by municipal charter and all that kind of stuff?
Well, they maybe had, they had a governmental angle to them because, you know, I mean, let me just say, there's nothing wrong with government. I mean, with governing our world, it's the sort of coercive touch where it's government by force that is where it tends to go wrong. Mm. When a corporation, when a company, you know, can put in a lot of money to build a channel tunnel and risk going broke if they don't make money and having, you know, losing it all, that keens the senses. It makes you much more thoughtful about what you're doing. But the government can go and spend, you know, billions of pounds trying to coordinate all the National Health Service information into one database. And after however many years they worked on it, say, oh, this isn't going well, screw that, can it? You know, £3 billion has gone down the drain.
Yeah.
There's absolutely nothing, and it's just coming out of our taxes. If it's coming out of, you know, shareholders' pockets, it's a different situation.
Yeah, there's little sign, by and large, of the shareholders losing money, I think. You know, we've got what is loosely a privatized rail network, for example, although it has extremely nationalized elements to it. And it gets subsidies from the government, which it hands to its shareholders, along with extraordinary price rises for season tickets and stuff year on year.
Well, but that's not an actual private company. I mean, they've privatized aspects of it, but it's still basically government run.
Yeah.
But they can lose their, you know, it's, I just can't bear the way the railways are. It's just crazy way it's been.
It is.
But you do get companies, you know, going broke, you know, when they screw up today.
Yeah.
Perrier used to dominate the water. That was pretty much the only spring water you could buy, aside from Malvern. And they contaminated their water. It got contaminated with benzene.
Yeah.
And they had to pull it all back. And that was when dozens of other companies got into the market. And Perrier is now a fringe brand.
That's pretty much what we need to do with the style of government we've got at the moment, I'd say. It's doing things on a daily basis that are similar to what Perrier did accidentally, and all it's doing is providing a service, a product, so it's not unreasonable to expect that the same thing might even happen to whole systems that we've got at the moment if people were to realise how iniquitous they were, if they were to respond to that.
It doesn't happen with governments, though. I mean, you've got examples all over the world of, you know, horrendous stuff going on in governments, and they survive it. You know, Brazil now, okay, Lula may go down. I mean, he nearly got a job as the assistant to the prime minister that would have made him immune to prosecution. You know, when you get hundreds of thousands or even millions of people out on the streets, sometimes it makes a difference. It didn't stop us from going to war in Iraq, the biggest demonstrations in the history of the world. It's a difficult one, but they can collapse on themselves. I mean, I don't see any way to engineer a change from the government that we have today, that style of government, into something more wonderful and sustainable. But I do recognize that all these systems collapse at some point. Nobody ever thinks they ever will collapse. When they do, they do. And the most important thing is for us to be kind of ready for that and not frightened of it.
Mm, yeah.
And actually not try and replace it with a demagogue like Donald Trump. I mean, at the moment, people are voting for extreme parties because they're so sick of the, you know, the choices that we've had to date. It's been, you know, maybe we could choose between, you know, cat shit and dog shit.
Yeah, or cat shit wrapped in dog shit.
Yeah. And now with somebody like, you know, Bernie Sanders, you've got horse shit. And with Donald Trump, you've got pig shit. And people are thinking, well, God, it can't taste, it can't be any worse than the shit we've been eating. Let's try something different. Let's try a different flavor of it. And, you know, we really need to recognize that we don't need that. The government is not a necessary evil. And there are better ways of managing ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. Yeah. And one of those would be for, I guess, government to notice some of the things that you're talking about, that the administration does actually, and the work does actually happen down here on the ground. And if lessons from the ground, as you say, from the bottom, were to travel to the top, then government might function a lot better, assuming, of course, that it does actually want to operate in our interests.
Yeah, I just, you know, you're talking there about, you know, this top-down government, the people in Westminster, and I really think that we can govern ourselves. And I know it's a very kind of radical thought, but we have done it in the past.
Yeah.
There's a sort of major Indus Valley civilization that went for up to 5,000 or 6,000 years of civilization there. And they had this is up to the 1100 BC. The first city was 7,500 BCE. And they had roads, they had plumbing, they had every house had a waste plumbing system that went into a mains waste system. They had a shipyard where ships came in and out. This is like, you know, before Christ. Dockyards. They had a standard measures throughout. They had 5 million people living in the Indus Valley. It was a really well-developed civilization without having any signs of warfare, of a nobility, of conflict. It is possible for humans. I mean, I don't know why it's so hard to get our head around the concept that we could live in peace and harmony with each other without having to slaughter each other to do it.
Yeah.
And yet people think, oh, no, we've got to kill each other. We've got to have men in uniform and prisons and jails because otherwise we couldn't cope. Well, we can cope. When you look at the Internet, you see corporations on the Internet who are bigger than some small countries.
Yeah.
And yet they manage their security and they deal with criminals, whether it's selling criminals or buying fire criminals, without courts, without jails, without police. And they do it with software. I mean, there are ways of excluding bad people from the system rather than, you know, I mean, it's just crazy, the system we have at the moment. You know, you go back to the 17th, 18th, 19th century, and they had jails, police. Well, police were a more recent introduction, but they had jails, people keeping the order, and judges and courts. And that system hasn't changed in all that time. And so somebody does us wrong, and what happens? They go through the courts and they go to jail, and we have to spend £40,000 plus a year keeping them in jail because they stole something out of a shop. There were better ways of dealing with that.
Yes, and like I say, the by and large, the people that end up in prison are people who have committed much smaller victimless crimes than are being committed at the top.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if there were not these sort of crazy, irrational laws on drug use that we have today, there would be absolutely no problem with prison space. They'd have to be closing down prisons.
Yeah.
Not building new ones.
Building twice as many as we had before. That was something. I think it's probably time we went for a music break, but I would like to talk when we come back a little bit about the drugs industry and the food stream, as it were, because they're part of this as well.
Okay.
And then, you know, have a look at your positive protest and your plans for emptying the corridors of power, if that's okay.
Okay, cool.
Brilliant stuff. Well, we'll stick on, I'm going to stick on Rob Heron and the Teapad Orchestra and a tune called Money Isn't Everything, because that's pretty relevant.
How appropriate.
Yeah, it's a great little tune, great words as well. So we'll be back with you folks in somewhere around 8 or 9 minutes. You're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show, and I'm talking with Gregory Sams. Like I say, back with you in 8 minutes or so, and here's some Rob Heron for you all. The Who there, and My Generation. I wonder what our generation is going to pull off, but I definitely feel there's a similar energy in us for change and rapid movement forward, don't you think, Greg?
Yeah, absolutely. It's there does seem to be an awakening in the air at the moment.
Yeah, as you say, vegetarianism has spread. What, you know, if you were the only one in the school, it wouldn't be the case anymore, would it?
Definitely not.
And it's another really complicated area because, of course, our medical system doesn't seem to know very much about nutrition. The governments appear to be extremely deeply involved in manipulating what it is we eat, you know, with the white flour and the white sugar and all the rest of it. And there seems to be quite a lot of effort to keep the whole meat thing running, but it's not really in our interests as humans or in the interests of our mother planet, is it?
Yeah, it's very, very difficult to undo laws and regulation because most of the MPs and congressmen in America are lawyers. And they spend, you know, enormous amount of time writing, you know, thousands of pages of regulation to try and force things to work. And even when they, in their heart of hearts, realize that we got it wrong or things have changed, undoing that and replacing it with something else is a gargantuan task. And the whole government involvement in the food industry for few generations now has been directed to putting more meat on our plates. And that has, you know, directed farmers towards the factory farm because that's the only way you can, you know, get meat at the sort of price people can afford onto everybody's plate. And of course, the cost of that, they didn't realize that while the meat might be, you know, X pounds a kilo, the additional cost of polluting the world, of the disease that arises, all the degenerative diseases that arise as a result of eating all that meat, not to mention the suffering and horror of it, those are all like massive extra costs. It's, you know, it's, somebody calculated some years ago that if there was no government involvement in the American meat trade, a burger would cost $11.
No.
And it's just, it's crazy. But once they've set that up, it's very hard to change it because, you know, farmers will start going out of business. All the things that are depending on this regulation will have trouble if it's stopped. And it's, yes, they are culpable. It's one of the reasons that, you know, meat is so big in our diet is because the government has engineered the whole industry to be that way. But when people change what they eat, we still have the freedom. They cannot, you know, they can't force you to take soup, take meat out of the shop when you go shopping. Mm. I mean, we all subsidize, we all pay for the production of meat, but they can't make us eat it. And when people start changing their diets, shops and supermarkets will respond and they will supply us with what we want to eat. And if that's organic food, if it's unrefined food, if it's vegetarian food, they will supply that. And if their organic food is, you know, is not the standard we want, we can demand higher standards. There are bodies like the Soil Association who actually put down good standards and enforce them and to make sure that people keep to them. Farmers markets are popping up all over the place where people can at least see the, you know, you see the people who are making your food, which makes a huge difference, whether it's organic or not.
Yeah, and I think that there you've done a really useful thing. You've drawn us back to where we started with the with the money, really, but the positive side of it, where we spend our money counts. What we buy with it counts. It's one of the, you know, if money is power, we do at least have a little bit of it, and our choice matters.
Yeah, I mean, we can't choose whether there's nuclear electricity in our wires, nuclear-powered electricity. Well, there are ways to affect that, but basically not a lot. So there are a lot of, and we can't decide whether our government goes to war or what type of weapons they use. But things that, you know, things like what clothes we wear, what food we eat, whether we drive cars or bicycles, that all that it is in our power to change, and that's a huge, huge amount of stuff that we can change.
And like you say, we don't need to have a plan. We don't need to know in detail where we're going. All we need to do is to take the first step, really.
Absolutely, absolutely, and nobody can declare by the year, you know, 2020, we're only going to be eating X amount of meat on our plates. That's really not how it works.
No. So the choice matters. And at your That your status out of date book, it must have been one of the earliest of its type, I would have thought, bringing this sort of stuff into the public wheel, as it were.
It was, in terms of modern times. One of my early readers, Mike J, said, "What you're writing reminds me of Kropotkin."
Oh, wow.
And I hadn't heard of Kropotkin when I wrote my book. I didn't know about this amazing, you know, Russian anarchist who had a completely peaceful view of how humanity could run itself. And I started to read Kropotkin. I said, "My God, this guy's, you know, he's written the same, a century ago or more, but he was very much on the same, or I was very much on the same path as him."
Yeah.
And he did an enormous amount of research looking into how medieval cities self-organized as corporations. So all the people in a city would form a company and belong to it, and this company would run their city. And they put walls up to protect them from these, you know, these gangsters out and living in castles in the countryside who had hoodlums on horseback and armor and swords who come in and demand taxes because they were the nobles who had to be supported by the commoners. And they said, "Screw that, you know, we're not going to do that." And there were pitched battles at times between cities and rulers who wanted them to be under their thumb.
Yes, there's been several examples in history, haven't there, of cities setting themselves up to do that and setting up guilds to ensure standards and all that kind of thing. And it does sound like it works considerably more simply than what we've got, and perhaps a bit better than what we've got at the moment.
Yeah, there are lots of ways to do it, and when you have a flexible system that's operating from the bottom up, it changes rapidly to suit circumstances. And you know, I have no idea how often eBay changes its, you know, upgrades its software to keep track of new ways that people are trying to use the system positively or abuse the system negatively. That's constantly being changed, their software, adapting to circumstances, where when you have to, you know, engineer it through lobbying and parliament and legislation and regulation, it's just, it's a hell of a way to try and keep up, and it doesn't keep up.
No, because it puts a whole lot of drag into the system, doesn't it, having to write all that stuff, identify it, put it into the special words, all that kind of thing, and quite often, it seems to me, if not inevitably, it seems to more or less achieve the opposite result, because it's largely because it's not responding immediately to a reality as such.
Yeah, it is. It's not responding. It's just not responding in a good way, and it's just saying, how can we force people into doing something else when people are making the change? I mean, at some point, the government might ban meat and say, okay, you know, we finally decided meat isn't good for us. It's costing us a lot of money on the national health. So we'll tax it or we'll ban it. As they have recently, they've taxed sugar.
Have they actually done that?
Well, they've said they're going to, they've imposed in the latest budget, they're putting a tax on sugar in soft drinks.
Right. Start of the ratchet, really.
It's just sucking more money out of our economy. And that's, which degrades us, degrades what we do. And at the same time, some of the money they're sucking out of the economy is going in subsidies to sugar growers. The UK sugar beet growers get some 250 million pounds a year in subsidy from the EU to grow sugar. Meanwhile, the government is taxing that same sugar. I mean, if they just removed the subsidy and the price of sugar went up, you know, that would achieve the same thing. But the subsidies are ingrained in law, and there's people administering them and taking them away, you know, and that's a whole system they can't change.
Well, because it's a system that's taking money out of the real economy, i.e. the economy of people who are using their hands to make things, and it does it at both ends, which is basically the fundamental aim of the system, as far as I can see, is to extract as much cash as possible from us.
Yeah, well, Jean-Louis Colbert, who was the finance minister for Louis XIV in France, he put it really well when he said the art of taxation consists in so plucking the goose as to obtain the maximum amount of feathers with the minimum amount of hissing.
Absolutely.
And that's all
right.
It's down to.
Yeah.
That's all it's down to. And if they start putting a high tax on sugar, on meat some days, so it's really expensive to eat meat, you'll find dogs and cats disappearing.
Mm.
You know, it's not the way to achieve positive change. But that's the only tool they've got is coercion.
Yeah.
Do this, we're going to hit you, or we're going to take your money, or we're going to tax it. You know, that's not how we operate with each other. It's not how you raise good children, by beating them when they're out of line. You know, it's...
I have a feeling, you know, that the television could be used for much more useful things than it is, in terms of actually changing what people are learning and understanding about life.
It is, but you'd have to then legislate that people watch TV to make sure they got the message. And
do you think they'd stop watching if you took EastEnders off and started putting yoga on instead? They probably would, you're right.
but people, or kids are spending more time watching what they choose to watch online these days than they are watching TV. I mean, I don't know how long TV is going to even survive.
Well, I'm glad to hear that that's true of the younger ones, because certainly a lot of the people I know of my age are pretty much buried in the telly, whether they like it or not. It's a bit weird, really.
It's certainly dropping off. It's dropping off.
That's another thing, see, that's changed, because we haven't had a telly for years, and we used to follow a magazine called White Dot, and like the telly used to make when you switched it off, and now they've got a website called whitedot.org, and there's a whole load more people without tellies than there used to be, for sure.
We were, my father, bless him, raised us without television. I mean, I never felt deprived, you know. I mean, it was like, so what?
Yeah, indeed.
He took us on trips and expeditions and, you know, traveling around. It was, you know,
Yeah, time of change. That was the very moment at which that changed, wasn't it? So your main aim with the state as out of date was to bring to people's attention the way things are. You didn't actually set out to come up with any solutions to it, but your kind of discovery of chaos theory has led you to realise that the order from the bottom up is more advantageous than the top down stuff we've got at the moment. But you did include in the end of your book a few kind of suggestions, and one of them was positive protest, which I quite liked. Would you like to explain to us what you mean by positive protest?
It's protest that enjoys what it's doing. So I got quite involved in the Reclaim the Streets, which was a big sort of phenomenon in the late 80s and some of the 90s. And it was a handful of people who thought that the paving over of our world has just gone too far. And it, you know, if you left it to the road building lobby, who were, you know, pushing the government at that point, eventually there would be, extreme statement, but eventually there'd be no green left. Everything would be paved over if they had their way, if they continued to have their way. So this is enough. We've got to put a stop to this. And they engineered completely nonviolent ways of protest that would achieve their aims and be fun at the same time. And I don't know if you're familiar with what Reclaim the Streets did, but I am,
because they were doing it in Oxford when I was living there.
Yeah, I mean, I went to their, I didn't get to the very first event on Camden High Street, but I got to everyone after that. And it was just extraordinary. I was telling some people in America, I went to a big conference in America, the Eris Society Conference, and meeting with these American libertarians and millionaires and patriots who were sort of very against the American government and what it was doing. And I was telling them, we'll just rewind a little bit. I'd actually been in the trenches at the Newbury Bypass protest a few weeks before I went to speak at this event in Aspen. And I was having conversations with these once left-wing socialist type protesters who were now anarchist freedom lovers. They're saying, you know, we want, you know, they didn't want anything to do with the government. They didn't want the government to, you know, be run by one person or the other. They were like outside of that system. And I was having similar conversations around the fire with them as I was having in an Aspen hotel room with these Americans who come from the right wing.
Interesting.
Both people had said, I don't want to be on this bird, right wing or left wing. It doesn't fly. And that was a big big deal there. And then Reclaim the Streets, and I was telling him how we did it in Reclaim the Streets without violence, how we would occupy a major stretch of motorway link up in the case of one of the parties, or main streets, and how the police couldn't do anything about it. They couldn't come in and shoot it. They couldn't, and these guys were just, their jaws dropped. He said, how do you do that without guns? They say, you don't need guns, mate. You know, peaceful is the way forward.
In fact, the last thing you need is a gun, really.
It doesn't, yeah, it really doesn't work. And they were all sort of absolutely pro-gun control. And I can understand why they wanted to be that way. But I'm just saying, what use are your guns going to be against the might of the American military? Forget it. It did say in the Constitution you have to maintain, you know, well-organized militias so that another George III never, you know, imposes his vile will on the people.
Yeah.
But you know, unfortunately, a few guns, even the high, heavy munitions some of these guys kept in the ones I met in Colorado, is not going to do it. But they tried it in Oregon, and they held out for a while, but you can't withstand that military. That's the tool that the government uses is weapons, and that's not the right tool to use against them because they're much better at it than we'll ever be.
In fact, it's the best way to engage with them, whereas your positive protest, which is basically do what you want to do, and if you can get in the way at the same time, cool.
Yeah, mess with their heads, do stuff that they can't actually put you in prison for, but that will be a major spanner in their works. And the British road building really did change as a result of the Reclaim the Streets protest.
It certainly did, yeah. Newbury made a big difference to them as well. And Ways and Meek, so that's a good one, I think, because it's encouraging people to make energetic progress in another direction, which I think personally is one of my favourite solutions is to just do the other thing, really, wherever possible.
Yeah.
You kick off your another little bit at the end in the solutions realm.
Emptying the corridors of power, is that the one you're coming to?
Yeah, I like that one. Yes, let's do that one, the one where you actually decide, well, you, as a result of a bet, you were kind of made to form a political party, weren't you?
It was something like that, yeah. It was a silly commitment I made, which I do like to keep my commitments. But I had this, what am I going to do? I'm going to run a political party in my friend Rainbow George's Rainbow Alliance, which is where I came up with, well, I adjusted it when I actually decided to run somebody for Parliament, and I called it the One Less Party. And all it did, it created, you're voting for one less politician. And you actually, you know, I ran somebody, a girl named Charlotte Reagan, as a candidate for Parliament. And she swore an oath, which I had vetted by a solicitor for 250 quid, the bastard charged. I wrote it. I just wanted him to say, yeah, it's okay.
Yeah.
She did. In which she promised, she swore, never to undertake any of the activities of being a member of Parliament. You know, she wouldn't take wages. She wouldn't employ staff.
Shall I read it? Because it's a good little oath. It's only a few lines. It's I undertake, if elected as a member of Parliament at the forthcoming general election, never to attend a session of Parliament or vote on any issues whatsoever, nor partake in any parliamentary committees or fact-finding missions, nor in any way to perform any of the functions of office normally associated with being an MP. I further undertake never to encash any payments forthcoming as wages, salary or remuneration for being an MP. I will never claim expenses, allowed or otherwise, for performance of functions I hereby swear not to perform. I will never employ or engage anybody on wages with regard to my position as an MP, be they relatives, friends or total strangers. I guarantee that I will never misrepresent my constituents or the people, or in any way attempt or pretend to represent them within the government and House of Commons. I will effectively do or not do everything possible in order to be simply one less politician. Great idea, mate.
I love hearing somebody else read that. It's good. Politicians, they are the problem. You know, we all know that. And if you could if you get rid of a few of them, I think it would send shockwaves throughout the world if a seat was emptied by that means.
Yes. Yes, and I think that's an ingenious way of doing it. It's close to another thing I heard from America, which I quite liked, which was simply vote out the incumbent. Simply make sure that in England, say, if everybody was to do that, just get rid of all 600 of them, give them 600 new ones, and when the next election comes, do the same thing again. Yeah. So great idea, really seriously tie their administration up. And the other thing I just wanted to touch on at the end of the book was the... what was it called? Ways and Means. It's a chapter 30, and you got a George Bernard Shaw quote at it, which says, "Liberty means responsibility. That is why most men dread it." And I think responsibility here is absolutely key, isn't it? If we're going to see this kind of organising from the bottom up, it's only going to occur when people start taking responsibility for what's happening around them.
Yeah, and people have started to take responsibility now for their diets. Once people realize that what they eat, this was a very radical new concept that we sort of pushed back in the 60s, but people recognize that what they eat affects their health and well-being, they take an interest in it, because it's not nice being sick. Even if the NHS is dealing with it for free, it's not a nice place to be. And you see people changing their diet because they're taking responsibility, which is changing the whole nature of the food industry, and they're not, you know, we're not going to get the government to do that for us. And there are all sorts of ways that are ensuring that our food is what we want it to be without resort to government. The government's got this huge sort of body that's, you know, trading standards and health officers and
Food and Drugs Administration.
And you know, because they want the food in restaurants to be healthy, they've got to comply with all sorts of regulations, and we end up with, you know, a mass of burger bars and fried chicken places and pizza takeaways because they can comply with the regulation. That's not safe, healthy food. But we have organizations now like Fair Trade. Fair Trade is growing at a major pace because people don't want, you know, third world workers to be abused in order to get them cheap peaches or whatever they're buying. So it's a real, you know, it's really heartening that people's morality supports something like fair trade.
And in the process generates a whole lot of little systems that do actually benefit people, the primary producers. It constantly amazes me that people producing food, fuel and fiber get paid basically the minimum wage or less, whereas the people at the top we were talking about earlier in the banks who are making money and making absolutely nothing get paid millions.
Exactly.
So creating organisations that encourage grassroots growing and grassroots distribution, all sorts of things, are really going to make a difference, aren't they?
It makes a fantastic difference. And I took my first Uber taxi ride. I'm in a wheelchair, so it's not, otherwise I'd have been using Uber for a long since it began. And this driver, he loved it. I'm sure some drivers have a problem with it. I'm going to sample one. But it was great. He was never more than 2 or 3 minutes without having a lift to pick up. He was actually on the corner opposite. A friend of mine called, you know, used his Uber account to call it.
What is an Uber taxi?
It's a it's people who have cars who drive who are willing to give other people lifts.
Great.
You're not familiar with Uber?
No. We barely even have taxis out here. In fact, we're just getting to grips with buses.
It's like Airbnb. Yeah. Only it's with cars. So you've got, you know, about 15,000 drivers in London in the Uber cars. You get it on your phone or your laptop. You sign in. You call for a taxi. The laptop knows who you are. I mean, so your computer knows who you are. You instantly get a price for the ride. If you say yes, your driver is going to be there. Their target, which they keep to, is 2 to 3 minutes before your car arrives where they're operating, and which is, you know, cities. You know the name of your driver. He knows your name when he picks you up. He takes you where you're going. You say thank you, and you get out on your way. You don't pay him. No money changes hands. That's all done through the Uber software, and it's you report if it was a bad taxi or a smelly taxi or the guy was a crappy driver, you comment on that. And likewise, if you're a smelly customer who tries to light a cigarette in the car or something, know, they both, you get the feedback there, and feedback loops are what drive change. You know, that's a very important part of a working civilization, of chaos theory, of things working, is feedback loops, things responding to each other, whether that's people or things.
I'm surprised we've got this far through this discussion without mentioning the feedback loops. Thanks
so
for
am
that
I.
Up.
Yeah. smack my wrist.
Because that's really where the speed and accuracy of response comes from, doesn't it? There's niches arising all the time, and the ingenuity of people is capable of filling them. I'm very impressed and excited by the Uber taxi idea. Is there any licensing or anything involved, or are they just men and women doing the best they can?
They vet the drivers. It started off in America. It's going all over the world now. You know, they've got taxi drivers coming out, you know, black cab drivers, and people protest against it.
I'll bet they are.
It's much cheaper, and it's using cars that already exist, that people already have. They might have a day job, but at night they get in their car and they drive around, and they're picking people up all the time.
And so I love taxis and buses and stuff, because it means random people are meeting random people as well. Mm-hmm. That there's all sorts of synchronicities are likely to arise. That's very exciting, Greg, that is. That's brilliant. Because that's actually an example that's not in the books of exactly what you're talking about. The idea that we can sort it out. We can do it better.
Yeah. And Airbnb is another great one. It's got more hotel rooms now, or more places to stay than the largest hotel chains in the world. And but it doesn't, you know, Airbnb doesn't own a single pillow, a single bed. It's all people using rooms that they have spare, spaces they have spare, and renting those out to other people. And all the messy financial stuff is done by Airbnb, and you just have guests. And again, you have the feedback loops on how your guests were, what the rooms looked like. It's just fantastic. It's connecting people and enabling us to exchange and, you know, interact with each other in all sorts of new and imaginative ways that in very often bypass the corporations.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. Yeah. And it means that people who don't necessarily want to stay in the uniform hotels and travel lodges and stuff have got somewhere that's affordable and probably really unique. You are going to find yourself in some very interesting places doing Airbnb.
Yeah, there's some weird little kind of place out in the woods in Northern California that's one of the most popular places in the Californian Airbnb. It's just great. They have castles.
Yeah, absolutely excellent. That I think. So this kind of, the organization, this sort of organization, which is kind of organization arising in a system without an organizer, yeah, is the kind of thing we're talking about there. And this kind of stream of thought took you kind of onwards from the State is Out of Date to this book, to your next book, The Son of God, because you seem to have seen in the Son a similar highly organized entity where there doesn't appear to be an organizer. Was that the kind of thing that drew you towards it?
That sounds very good, Doctor. but it's not quite the case, actually.
Oh, well, there you go.
I mean, in reality, I guess it is. In terms of the steps and the linkage, it didn't look that way. It didn't appear that way when I was doing it. Because I realized that at a certain point, or in 1999 it was actually, that I had to do another book. I'd been out to sort of countless parties, events. Every weekend I was promoting my book at two or three different events. And after a couple of years of doing that, I was getting, I was sort of offering my flyer to people who I'd had a long conversation with 6 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And they would be offended that I didn't remember our long conversation, but I was having like hundreds of thousands of long conversations. And I thought, geez, I got to write a new book. And I actually had a list of half a dozen different ideas. I was kind of interested. It could be a book on this. I could write a book on that. And I started writing a book on intelligent evolution, which was actually the cover of, I haven't opened it up yet, the cover of the New Scientist that came through in the Post this morning. Because I was sure that the intelligence of our body was going to take note would take note of the sort of climate or the conditions we lived in, whether it's us or plants or animals, and adjust the genome consciously to facilitate those changes we're witnessing. Now, there might be lots of different approaches taken to how that was done. And this was, you know, completely, there was something called Lamarckism. There's a scientist called Lamarck who put this forward a few centuries ago. And the science did, they sort of, it's either or, it's either nurture or nature. They can't accept that it could be both.
I remember that argument, yeah.
Still a daft argument. They're still having that argument.
Like,
but I was saying, no, the gene is going to change. And I started to write this book, and I was a little way into it, not that far, you know. 5 or 10 pages, to be honest. And I went off on a sidetrack about the sun and about, because I'd always recognized the sun, not always, from the age of 17. I had a seminal experience in Berkeley, California, where I was staring into the sun for quite a while on this hilltop in one of my first sort of psychedelic adventures. And I recognized it wasn't a dead, dumb ball of gas.
It communicated with you.
It was a two-way stream going there when I was, I just recognized this. I never did anything with that other than appreciate the sun more than most people would. And I thought, so it was a sidetrack writing another book. And after a couple pages of that, I said, hey, this is my book. Well, why didn't I think of this before? I'm going to write a book on the conscious sun.
And you hit on something that is a massive subject that, as far as I can see, nobody else has chosen to have a go at.
No, I mean, it was thinking, you know, at one point before the Christians came along, you know, being a sun priest, if you like, was the prime job, or one of the prime jobs on the planet. And here we are, there's none of them. And it was like we recognized that the Christians and the Bible don't have everything exactly right. You know, the world didn't start 8,650 years ago or whenever the creation. And, you know, all these ancient cultures, I mean, all of them, whether it was the Norse or the Egyptians or the Mayans or the Japanese or the Hindus, they all recognized that that which brought us the light of life knew life itself, and that it wasn't some accidental source of heat in the sky. And you know, the Christians then firmly said, no, it is. Everything is this invisible God we don't know anything about, but he created all this stuff to heat us up on Earth. And he created the stars so that we could look, you know, decorate our night sky, basically, and then figure out when to plant things according to their movement. But they had no idea. And when I started looking into it, I said, okay, well, I better study the science on this. And I was studying all the solar science and cosmology we had, even in the year 2000, and it all seemed to support this idea much more than it supported a dead, dumb ball of gas. And the more that they study about the sun, the more inexplicable it is, and the more mysterious it is. They can't explain the sun's
corona. It actually challenges quite a lot of the physical theories that exist, doesn't it? I mean, that's one of the things that it was, in fact, I think it was the thing that impressed me most about your Son of God book, was your actual chapter on the description of the many layers of the sun.
Yeah.
And just how complex it is. I mean, is that a subject that's capable of brief summary, do you think? Is that an unfair question?
No, it's absolutely fair. There's like, it was new to me that they were identified anyway, 7 different layers to the sun, and they're all doing absolutely different things. In the core, you've got this sort of raging nuclear fusion reaction. You know, unbelievable that there's 5 million tons of the sun's mass is converted to energy every second or every minute.
I think every second, you said.
Yeah. And in Hiroshima, in the first nuclear bomb in Hiroshima, the equivalent of 1 penny's worth, 1 new pence worth of matter was converted to energy. So that's an enormous amount, 5 million tons. And that would be a massive explosion, but, you know, the next layer, I'm not going to go through all these layers, but the next layer is the diameter of 25 Earths, and it's the density of gold where it surrounds this fusion reaction. And then there's another layer, and there's this...
And that's plasma at the density of gold.
It's all plasma, yeah. Plasma conducts electromagnetic energy really well. It's, you know, we have solid, liquid, and gas, and that's what we, the world we live in. 99.9% of the universe is plasma, which is a whole different form of energy where it's not a stable, perfect balance of electrons and protons. So it's fluid, and it's lightning is one of the few examples of plasma we have on this Earth, unless you see those plasma balls with those, you put your hands on the outside of the glass and all those electrical plasma things come and touch you. It's fabulous.
Yeah.
But that's, but then you've got the corona of the sun, which is like, that's the invisible energy field that surrounds it. And it's got 2 to 3 times the area of the sun itself is this invisible electromagnetic field that we can only see in a total solar eclipse. And it's this, it's curious because the solar scientists, they identify the corona as the most mysterious, most inexplicable aspect of the sun. And yet they credit it with managing sunspots, solar flares, coronal mass ejections, and coronal filaments, these 4 things that are happening on the sun.
I love that. We don't know anything about it, but we think it's doing this.
I know. Great. But then, you know, the most mysterious aspect of human existence is our consciousness. Where is it? What is it? How is it? And yet, we know that that consciousness is managing all the bits of our life that we are able to manage. Like, where am I going to go on holiday? What am I going to have to eat? Do I like this person or loathe them? That's all our consciousness doing that. And yet we don't know anything about it, except that we're the only person we're the only thing that has it.
Yes.
Nothing else could possibly have consciousness, you know, except us, even though we don't know anything about it. And I just think, you know, it's kind of,
I think the questions we're asking are kind of observation of the sun and our observation of consciousness. It struck me, having read your book, we've got very much the same questions about both of them, haven't we? Because, I mean, your description of the structure of the sun and the temperatures and the fact that one bit of it rotates in one direction and another bit of it rotates in at different speeds and differentially from itself, and there's totally inexplicable temperatures being generated in the corona and thereafter, where you do a fantastic metaphor where you say it's like we're remote watching something like a Wimbledon tennis player, and we can see all of the things that's happening, you know, all the pulse rates and the breath and all of that, but we've got no idea what it is. We've come to pretty much that conclusion about consciousness and the sun, haven't we? We've got what we physically see, but we don't really know the first thing about either of them.
Well, it's like, yeah, I mean, with the tennis player analogy, it's like they know pulse rate and breath and all of this and temperature, but they don't know there's a game of tennis going on.
Right.
And we've got this scientist, they're analyzing all these things about the sun and measuring this and measuring that and keeping track of this, and yet they don't recognize it's a celestial being up there.
Mm.
And that's just such a missing piece of the knowledge. And that's strictly because they used to get burned for thinking such things.
Well, that's an interesting point you make, isn't it? Is that for many, many years it was religion that was stamping on it, but now religion used to say you just weren't allowed to think it and that it was nonsense, and science now says it's superstition.
Well, because it's scientific tradition to view, because they had to view the sun as a dumb ball of gas or plasma, and they somehow think that's a scientific viewpoint, and it's not. That's they're keeping to a Christian taboo,
yeah,
when they espouse that, and they quite easily threw away the creationist side of the Bible, because the Christians never used to burn anybody for the coming up the theory of evolution, because nobody had that. It didn't exist then, but sun worship did. So that had to be stamped out heavily. But prior to Christianity, if you look at, you know, great figures of science, whether it's, you know, Aristotle or Ptolemy or Euclid, you know, all the ancient, they never had this block. They could look at mystical things in a scientific way and come to various conclusions on it. But you know, our modern scientists can't do that because Christianity had a monopoly on things spiritual. You can go anywhere you go you like, but don't look into spirituality. That's our turf, and you'll burn more than your fingers if you go there. Mm. So that's one of the objectives of my book, is to just get this through, get a few of these cosmologists to consider that maybe we live in a living universe and we're not the only living thing in an expanse of deadness.
Which is going to be an extremely difficult thing to convince people of if they don't believe that dogs and mice, say, are conscious, let alone worms.
Well, yeah, people who had dogs and mice or dogs and cats do sort of think that they're conscious, but Descartes, who famously set the mold for the scientific view of all other life forms, he famously pinned his own dog to the kitchen table and cut it up because he knew that its screams and wails and squeals were nothing more than the squeaks of a machine that hadn't been oiled properly.
And they used to think that about babies as well, didn't they? They thought that they felt no pain until they were 6 months old or something, and their squealing was just a similar, like Descartes' dog, really.
That's right, just some sort of a automatic response to stuff.
It's pretty odd, isn't it? I mean, what I find really odd about all of this is that, okay, you know, the Spanish went over to Peru and they found entire golden temples made to the sun, which they then just melted down and dragged back to Spain. We understand that Akhenaten and Zoroaster both went for kind of, you know, sort of one god, but it was the sun and all of that. And we know that before that, all over this beautiful blue globe, it was the sun that people were looking to. Now, Christianity appears to have tried to do something different, but it follows the model. The story of Jesus follows the model and the story of the sun as it travels in a year, and it is the successor to 25 other religions, including Mithras and a load of others, Isis, that did exactly the same thing. So they've not so much kind of replaced it as simply disguised it, and that it's a bit mystifying to me why they should have wanted to do such a thing. Do you have any idea?
Well, it was a wise choice, because there was a very different type of god and a prophet-driven god. You'd never had gods that actually came down to earth and spoke to people. You know, somebody who was responsible for the entire universe is going to speak our language and tell us what sort of clothes to wear and how to cut our hair and what to eat. You know, that was a very new concept. And to when it was basically when the Roman Empire adopted it as their official religion in the 4th century. We don't really know what was what existed prior to the Council of Nicaea, because that was where all the bishops got together, decided what the story was going to be. Everything else then had to be destroyed. Everything else was illegal that didn't toe the new official line. And to probably at the Council of Nicaea, they probably decided, okay, we're going to make Christ's birth on December 25th, because that's already an established holiday that people, all of our our flocks keep to, and they already know the stories of the virgin birth, and so many of the legends of Jesus were pre-existing legends. So it was an easy way to sell it to the people. I don't know, my personal whimsical theory on why the Romans finally made it their official religion was because they saw the advantages of, you know, you're running this despotic empire, and you've got a religion that tells people to love their enemy. If he asks for your shirt, give him your jacket as well. Suffering is the route to heaven. You know, wow, this is great. People want to believe this stuff. We're going to make it our official religion.
There's a YouTube video turned up recently by a guy, I can't remember the details, it's just sprung to my mind, who's pointed out that there's a writing technique in Jewish scripts which involves including in the correct order many events that happened in a previous story. And his conclusion is that he understands these ancient languages, and so has read the source documents, and he says that when you look at Jesus' life, it contains within it, I think it was 20 or 30 events, which parallel exactly the events in the life of the Roman Empire, who eventually beat the Jews and destroyed the temple in Jerusalem. And it's suggested that he's pretty sure, in fact, from the evidence, that in fact Vespasian, one of these Roman emperors, actually created Jesus. The cult of the Roman emperor kind of created him, wrote about him, and put him 40 years in the past, so that it looked like the events in Jesus' life were actually prophesying the events in the war that were going to be executed by Vespasian. And so Jesus then becomes some kind of cipher for a Roman emperor, and it becomes clear that if that's the case, and you know they destroyed everything else, that the Romans actually wrote the stuff about Jesus, which is why he fits so ideally as you suggest he might.
It's quite possible. I mean, obviously there's a lot of really good stuff in Christianity and the New Testament that people, you know, but you know, you don't necessarily need to be told, you don't need, you know, tablets of stone coming down from heaven to tell you that it's not good to kill your neighbor or sleep with his wife or their partner. But we just don't know. I mean, I over in a period of a year or two, I was exposed to two different very convincing works. One is by an American woman who's sadly no longer with us, Acharya S., she's known as, who really, amazing scholar, knew lots of the ancient languages, and she maintains that Jesus Christ never even existed. And she's got an amazing amount of data and history to support that.
Yeah, I've read several scholars making that argument very convincingly.
And the other a book I read, which was also very convincing, maintained that Jesus survived the crucifixion, because it's not, you know, you don't get, if you get killed, you die of exhaustion, and some people could perhaps have survived that and resuscitated, so that he did come back to, he never died. And that when he came back to consciousness after 3 days, he said, screw this, and he pissed off to Kashmir and ended his days in Kashmir as a known prophet. And there are temples to him there. There is this sort of story of a character with a name like Jesus who ended his days happily in Kashmir, continuing to preach and, you know, improve people's lives. So
I think there must have been people like Jesus for the Romans perhaps to base their story on, which might explain the kind of the many spread stories around the world of Jesus visiting practically everywhere, really.
But I don't, in neither of my books, I don't really get too involved in, you know, conspiracies and secret societies and who did what to whom.
Yeah,
you can easily get lost in that. It's fascinating, and it's all right for movies. It's very entertaining stuff.
I think it's one of the best things about your books that you don't do that. I think that's what makes them so potentially much more widely, you know, readable to people, the fact that you don't do that.
Yeah, because I often think, you know, if I knew the answer to this, how would it affect my life tomorrow? Is it really going to make a big difference knowing that this guy was a conspiracy and this was fake? I mean, I even go as far as to say that I don't really, to me, it doesn't really matter whether Uncle Sam or the Taliban brought down the Twin Towers.
Yeah.
It's a huge conspiracy if it was the American government. It's a huge conspiracy if it was the Taliban. But, you know, that kind of stuff has been going on for centuries. And what we've got to do is, you know, not figure out who did it, but stop it from happening. That's the most important thing.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, very
and
fair.
With, you know, whatever, whoever and whatever Jesus Christ was, then what is really important is to focus on the spirituality and how we connect with the spirituality of the world and what's going on out there. And we're not going to get a lot of guidance from that out of the Bible, I'm sorry to say.
No, even though the Bible is a thinly disguised story of the sun itself. And perhaps we should go for another music break now.
I would say a thickly disguised story.
Thickly disguised, yeah, indeed. But as you say, I agree with you, it's got a lot of useful stuff in it. But again, as you point out very eloquently in your book, the basic golden rule of, you know, do to others as you would have done to you is actually applied by all of them, every single one, as far as I can see. I think you quote a dozen examples or something in the book. So it's known stuff, like you say, in the book, man sort of already learnt the basic lessons of religion and didn't really need it, but we'll get into how this connects with the sun and stuff after I've played Eddie and the Hot Rods Do Anything You Want to Do, because I think we should, don't you?
Okay, yeah.
And
we'll play on.
Brilliant.
Let's do it.
You're listening to www.peoplesinternetradio.com, seeking solutions.
Excellent, I love that tune. Tracy Curtis and Don't Sit Silently, from Thoughts in the Dark, I think that one was on. Welcome back. You're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on peoplesinternetradio.com, where tonight we're seeking solutions with Gregory Sams. Welcome back, Greg, for your last stint. You're doing very well, sir. Thank you. Oh, hang on a moment. I've forgotten to press your green button. There you go. He's on now. You'll be able to hear Greg now.
Okay,
yeah, very good. There's been a couple of questions in the chat box whilst we've been on the break. Mithrin asked, both of them, I think. One of them was with regard to the Uber taxis. Is there any special insurance that people have to get to do that, or do they just do it?
Well, you'll find all that on the Uber website, but they are insured. And I know with Airbnb, they have £1 million cover.
Mm-hmm.
If your guest who damages your house or does something bad, they have up to £1 million. They will.
Okay, so that's that.
They're very attentive to that sort of thing. Yeah,
But it sounds like it's being covered actually by the people who set the thing up, rather than by the whatever 15,000 taxi drivers or whatever.
Well, I think their taxi drivers arrange their own insurance, but they have to have a level of insurance that is acceptable. Yeah.
Okay, that's great. And the other question Mithrin asked is something I've not heard about: is that apparently people have seen spheres being refueled by the sun. Have you seen that?
I haven't seen it happening. I've seen people talking about it, and I gotta say, it's a little bit woo woo for me. The sun is quite hot, and for me, the idea of a craft coming right up to its surface and somehow refueling. If you've got the technology to fly craft out in space, you're not going to have to land on the sun to refuel. You'll be able to get the energy through much more.
Yeah, especially being as I think it's being heavily implied now, right now, that that if there are such craft moving around, then it's charge that's doing the job, and the whole solar system, everything is charge. So I tend to agree with you that the thing is, you can see so much on YouTube, can't you? There's, as you said, there's cities on the moon, there's just stuff going down all the time, and you've got no way of knowing what you're looking at.
I sort of do filter. Sometimes I filter stuff out that I shouldn't, but I... sometimes I get caught out, but
we can only look at so much, can't we? Yeah. Quite apart from anything else. Anyway, so we're living on a big blue ball where most people used to recognize the sun for what it is, which is, as you say, a celestial entity, and treated it with a degree of respect. That got kind of funneled down somehow to the three monotheistic religions we've got now. So although we've got one God, we've now got three versions of him, so it's not really sorted anything out there. But it appears to me that Christianity, which is the one that I know most about, is about light. All of the characters, all the main characters have got halos around them.
Mm-hmm.
Loads of the main stories are actually telling us the same pagan stories as we would have heard about the movement of the sun through the sky as the year goes by. So it seems to me that although there's a degree of disguising going on and stuff, that we are fundamentally still talking about light. And Jesus even said, I am the way, the truth, and the light, didn't he?
Yeah, that is what gives those Abrahamic religions their power, if you like, because they've taken the light from a different religion, from Zoroastrianism and possibly from Akhenaten legacy. But they've picked up on light, but they've subjugated it. They've made light something that was created by their God.
Let there be light.
And their God is some character who's kind of like us, who said, okay, it wasn't even the first thing he created, or she created, said, let there be light. And that's not how even though it says it in the Bible, that's not how it works. And Zoroastrianism, which is one of the oldest religions, if not the oldest religion on the planet, recognized light itself as the divinity, and not as and as that which was the source of all subsequent creation, and the source of consciousness, the source of wisdom, and we use that in our language when we talk about seeing the light, or being delighted when we're filled with joy, or the lights go out and we die, you see the light in people's eyes. It's imbued in our language. We subconsciously understand the nature of light, and we imbue it with goodness and divinity and inspiration. But you don't think about it in Christianity. The Abrahamic religions don't really big up light. It's always the secondary thing. And we sort of take it for granted whilst we worship all these other characters and aspects. And there's a great Robert Anton Wilson quote, which I like, which is, nobody sees the obvious, nobody observes the ordinary. There are more miracles in a square yard of earth than there are in all the fables of the church. And light is one of those things, you kind of take it for granted, but it's a miracle that surrounds us, it powers us, it tells us everything we know about the world around us.
It's true, it's really underestimated, isn't it? Because it's a supplier of heat, it's a supplier of information. Our main source of information about the world is through our eyes, and the same is true of a lot of the critters on Earth, conscious or not, and without light we wouldn't see any of it.
And light is, and we only that stuff we see is just a tiny part of the wavelength of light, which extends from, you know, X-rays and gamma rays down to long-wave radio waves that can be a kilometer long. And that's what, as well as, you know, that's all of communication is done through that, through Wi-Fi and through TV and through radio and through X-rays. That's all different frequencies of light that we're conveying information with. And it is the ultimate mystery, too, which, and you want God to be an ultimate mystery, you know, beyond our comprehension, understanding. And that's Richard Feynman, a physicist famously said, anyone who says they understand quantum theory doesn't understand quantum theory.
Absolutely right, yeah.
Quantum theory is all about light.
Yeah.
And the more you study quantum theory, the more mysterious light becomes.
Yeah.
And these are almost exactly the same words that Zoroaster and Zoroastrians say about light, that it's beyond human comprehension, that it's pure energy.
So it's possible that we comprehended this a long time ago and then forgot about it, like so many other things.
Well, Zoroastrianism, it's still a religion, but there was a Persian Empire, and empires die. They get, you know, wiped out, and the Zoroastrians were, the Muslims did them a lot of damage, then the Mongols did, and they all, it's a long story anyway.
Yeah.
And a brilliant story, but coming back to the light, you know, I have a chapter on light in the book Son of God, and it was the most exciting chapter to write. It just kind of, as the light was coming to me, if you like, and as I was thinking about it, it was just mind-blowing. And you think, we are light. I mean, all of our energy comes from sunlight that has been stored in plants or animals that eat the plants, and then we're recycling that as human life.
And in the process, we give off light, don't we?
We give off light. There is, and all of our processing, our cells communicate with photons. And all this, if you take that light away, the lights go out and we're dead. So in a sense, all this physical stuff, all the food we eat, the bones, the flesh, the muscles, it's all there to facilitate this light, to have as a vehicle for this light to travel through.
Mm.
And it's the most important thing in our lives. And the light comes from the sun. And so those two guys recognized that it wasn't that the sun was a representative of the light, Zoroaster and Akhenaten. Our sun represents the light, but the light itself is the divinity. Mm-hmm. And that's so much higher than saying God created light. How do you create light?
Mm. And the sun actually steps it down, doesn't it? Because it does start off from the core with really, really high-intensity gamma rays.
That's right.
Which somehow transform themselves through completely unknown means into the light that does exactly what you're saying.
And the visible light.
And because there's 7,000 million even humans on the planet, and I don't know how many mice and all the other critters, all of whom cells are dividing, and every time they divide, they give off photons. So this kind of step-down light that is coming from our sun is actually creating more light on this planet because of all the photons that are being given off. So at our level, it's kind of stepped down further as a result of what we do with light. But it looks to me like an extension of the same process.
Yeah. It's light is going through these countless transformations and transmutations as it travels from the sun into all the other manifestations it has. And one of which, of course, is fire. When you're looking at a log burning, that fire is the sun's energy that was stored in it. The earth elements come out as carbon and water vapor. And that's one of the reasons why gazing into a fire is so magnetic and gripping, because it's actually a step-down version of sun gazing that you don't have to sort of squint your eyes for or train to be able to do. And it's not coincidental that every single religion on the planet has candles involved. They have fire. It's this connection between the physical world and the spiritual world, because matter is turning to spirit in that flame.
Lovely. That's very good indeed. I like that. And I suppose in that we're seeing there the unity of matter and spirit, or matter and energy. And it's my feeling that the Abrahamic religions have made a point of making a distinguishment between the two. So spirit is God, and what happens after all of this, and somehow matter is kind of disposable, and it sort of forms the grounding for all the damage that we're doing, this separation. Whereas in fact the sun, as you call it, without the sun, is actually a manifestation of the unity of the two things, matter and spirit, or matter and energy.
Yeah, it's coursed, it's totally coursed with electromagnetic energy traveling through it, which is again another form of light, and it's created out of a loose cosmic cloud of dust, coalesces into this very complex organism called a star. And that is not an accidental process. They now recognize that the electromagnetic force plays a part in that. It is the director of this transformation of matter, loose dust, into a organism. And what does this creation do? It turns matter into light. So you've got light organizing matter in order for it to turn matter into light, which is then coming down here and turning into matter on the earth as trees and plants and people grow. And because photosynthesis means made by light. Yeah. It's water and air and sunlight are the ingredients of the vegetable world. The earth is an anchor for it and supplies trace elements like we get in vitamins and minerals. So it's
as
you say, they express light again. We express that light back.
Yeah, and that presumably is going on and expressing more light further down the chain. It's very like, isn't it, this old, the ancients' idea that what we see in Earth is the mother of form, matter, material, rising to meet the father of consciousness, which is pattern, information, and that the two things are melded absolutely perfectly here. But it takes both. We're kind of like we're like a transducer of a matrix that's formed by the earth and the sun.
Sorry, it's banged into the microphone. Yes, we are. I don't know. It's life is such a mystery. Why we're here, what it's about. And to me, knowing the source of my life and knowing that I am sunlight transmuting, my life is transmuted sunlight into something else, it gives it power, and it also, you get inspiration from the light. It's not accidental that we incorporate that into our language when all the sort of knowledge gaining things are shedding light on stuff.
And recognition of that link really does inspire more inspiration, doesn't it? Because you can have an actual conscious connection with something once you recognize its importance.
You do, and the Zoroastrian religion ascribed goodness and truth and wisdom and bliss were all qualities of the light that they recognized very consciously, and they had the whole creed of Zoroastrianism is six words, which is good thoughts, good words, good deeds. That was their equivalent of the golden rule.
Excellent. That's really good. I like that. So we've got, we know that our, all of our internal systems communicate through electricity and light. Those are the two things that kind of happened even inside biological organisms.
Yeah. Cells, they now believe that all cells probably communicate with light.
Yes. And so if the sun is a kind of sentient conscious entity, as we're trying to suggest here, we would expect to find equivalents of that communication system within our body in the solar system, wouldn't we? We'd expect to see electromagnetic connections between the sun and the planets, sun and the stars, possibly between our galaxy and other galaxies. Do we see that sort of evidence?
We do indeed. And this has all been taking place since I wrote the book, because the electromagnetic fields of stars and the universe is a new field of study, because they're invisible, so you need quite high technology to detect them. But the year my book came out, NASA discovered what they call a magnetic portal that links Earth to the sun. And it's this cylindrical electromagnetic field that extends, it's a diameter of Earth, and it extends from Earth to the sun, and there's another one that comes out of the sun's corona that extends towards Earth, and every 8.5 minutes they join together. They link up, and tons of high-energy particles pass back and forth between them. This is NASA's. They've got 4 satellites that are looking at this and studying it, and they're blown away by it. Still don't think maybe they're communicating or sending messages back and forth. They still have to look on all this as random activity, and it's so obviously not.
What the hell is this stuff if it's not information?
Yeah, it's...
We've even built technologies now that actually mimic that, and we're using it for transferring information.
Oh, yeah, we do that with, as I said, with radio, with Wi-Fi, with TV. I mean, my little Wi-Fi, it's whole movies come onto my iPhone. I mean, it's just unbelievable that the information that can light,
and it guides,
we're transmitting with light,
and it guides ferries backwards into tiny little docks, and all of it, everything we're doing is doing that, and effectively. This is kind of, like I say, we're sort of mimicking the big system. The sun's doing stuff which looks really, really, really like our communication systems.
Yeah. And galaxies, they've identified giant electromagnetic fields linking galaxies across deep space. They haven't yet. I'm convinced that there are links between our sun and the other planets in the solar system. And I would not be at all surprised if there were links between stars and stars, if galaxies are connected by them and stars are connected to their planets. And if that is indeed the case, then you could look on a galaxy like a brain. Coincidentally, it's about the same amount of neurons in our brain as there are stars in the Milky Way. And if they are linked by electromagnetic fields, as are neurons linked through synapses, which are not hardwired connections, they pass electromagnetic signals and chemicals across the gap. So if stars are doing that, this galaxy could be a brain. Every star has its own electromagnetic signal or note that it sends out.
I love that.
But the galaxies has not a cacophony of all the stars within it, but another singular note that it sends out.
How did Plato know about the music of the spheres? And something you write about in your book as well is that the sun's got acoustic qualities, which I haven't read about.
Yes, it vibrates. I did see a piece recently suggesting that it vibrates when you make its vibration audible by moving it up a few scales. They were saying it's the om sound, but I don't know whether I'm not saying that's the case. It sounds really lovely though, and I'd like to think that's true.
Yeah, I'd like to hear that. So effectively, I mean, I love this. There's a whole load of stuff being piled round light, and Christianity is actually an embodiment of that stuff. It has got the information in it. It's got the pictures of the halos. It's got the story of Jesus rising from the dead after 3 days and all that kind of stuff. But you quote Alan Watts in your book, and you say we're all in a giant restaurant where we're sitting around ignoring the food and eating the menus. He's great, isn't he? So how, you know, in the, we've got 10 or 12 minutes left, how do we get to the food? How do we stop eating the menus and start getting to the food?
Well, you start spending more time thinking about and considering the star in the movie of life, our sun. And then we do choosing sunglasses and just thinking about sunblock. Because it's a major, it's the most important thing in our lives is the sun. And that, just the knowledge of that takes you where you need to go. It's not something to be frightened of. We're still, you know, have this fear of the sun imbued in us. They can't sort of execute us for worshiping. Well, I say not in England, America, and Europe anyway. But we don't think about it. It's nobody gives it a second thought.
Mm.
That's the main aim of my, I mean, there's lots of other information in the book, but that's the most important bit. And the other information in the book is what I recognized when I sort of explored, okay, if stars are conscious beings, what does that mean? What are the inevitable, you know, consequences of that? And that's fascinating to go there. But, you know, so the sun's light is very healing. You know, it's not something we need to protect ourselves with. No. I mean, some people do if you've got light skin and red hair, but, you know, judgment is used. But it cures so many more ailments than it does, you know, cause skin cancer in rare cases. It's a very beneficial thing.
So recognizing the light for what it is, which is the source of everything, from gathering dust together to turn it into the molecules and atoms that become us, to providing us with everything we see, all the energy and all the heat and all the wood we burn is stored sunlight. To recognize that is really important. Sun gazing, you've already mentioned, people seem to think that gazing at the sun, you know, when it's comfortable at sunrise or sunset, actually informs us. And I know you'd back that up, wouldn't you?
Very much. And I do a lot of sun gazing, and sometimes I'll sun gaze in puddles or in the water or in the reflected in a window, and it's quite easy because it's been sort of reduced through the reflection.
Great.
Or through trees. You know, when I can look at the sun without any squinting,
yes,
I do it.
Yeah.
And if I'm squinting, then it's too bright.
Okay. And so you're saying looking through the kind of leaves of a tree rustling so that the sun's actually being interfered with, but you're still staring at it.
Yeah.
Like a filter.
Exactly. So you're getting, you know, 60% of the light or 30, whatever.
People say it's worth greeting trees, and I've had that experience myself. Do you think it's worth saying hi to the sun?
Oh, absolutely. I do it all the time. Good morning, sun.
Yeah. And there's that, you mentioned it in the book, there's the sun salutation in yoga, isn't there, which I remember shows every single bit of your body to the sun.
Yeah. And there was a group of parents in California who insisted that their school, you know, stop teaching kids yoga because there was a sun salutation in that, and that's sun worship and that bad stuff.
No, really?
And it's the most appalling thing you can do in Islam is to respect the sun, which is why their prayers are done before sunrise, after sunset, and after noon, because they don't want anything that could be linked to the sun. And you know, this is a rare window of opportunity when I can talk about this sort of stuff and not be absolutely be trashed one way or another. Goethe saw it, but he didn't say anything about it till he was on his deathbed. And he confided to a close colleague that he recognized the sun as a divine entity, but as the representative of an even higher force that we can't understand, i.e. light. The landscape artist, J.W. Turner, his last words were, "The sun is God." He couldn't say it when he was alive. And this was 150 years ago or so. He couldn't say it when he was alive because he would have ruined his reputation. In any Islamic countries, in Saudi Arabia, I would be beheaded for talking about a book like this.
Crazy. I mean,
it's a sobering thought. And you know, we don't know. People, you know, if fundamentalist religion regains a hold, you know, in 10 or 20 years' time, this sort of talk might be illegal. We just don't know.
So we need to take advantage of it whilst we can.
Well, and embed it, you know.
Yeah.
I think the food thing has gone beyond pushing back. I mean, I think people are not going to stop eating, demanding good food. I think, but it's at any point in time that might have changed. We have to create our world. We can't expect it to be created
I think
for
we,
us.
We do know as well that basically the whole thing's like a pendulum, you know, like the yin and yang sign. That there's going to come a point when there's only one pixel of light left in the sign. But at that point, you'll get 2 pixels of white, and then 4, and then 8, and that's going to go on until there's only 1 pixel of shadow left. And that change has to happen at some point, and I think we're living in it. And the thing is that to participate in that is to help it happening, and is probably also the reason for why it does happen. And there seem to be so many of us now making so many new moves, and, you know, a simple solution, like looking at the sun, like recognizing it, like recognizing the seasons, the equinoxes and the solstices, another very popular thing here, because those are key points in the sun's life.
People are connecting. People are connecting in unbelievable ways. I mean, in positive ways, because I've been at this since the late 60s, and for every one person then, there are tens of thousands now who are looking within and eating good food and doing yoga and meditating and wanting a better world, and thinking realizing that we have a part in creating that better world. It's just, it's a wonderful change to have seen. And I keep reminding myself of that when I see the horrendous stuff being done by the military industrial complex and the bankers and the crap that's going on.
Well,
I will remember there's so much more positivity out there too.
Yes, and the positivity is simple and accessible. And what we were talking about earlier about not needing a plan but taking the first step, that's the way I tend to think about the armies and the nuclear power stations and all the rest of it, is that they will be addressed by progress, by people taking the first step and then the second step. And, you know, we have to deal with the stuff on the ground first, but the rest of it is all just a product of our consent as well. And as we withdraw our consent, that too will pass.
Yeah. I mean, there are so many things that we can be doing, that we should be doing. And even if we can't see how they're going to solve the big problem, we should do them. Because that's how big problems get solved. That you say that's the beginning of the process.
I think that's absolutely brilliant, Greg. Very good place to finish that. Thank you very, very much.
Okay, it's been a pleasure.
It's been a real pleasure talking to you as well.
Congratulations on 200 editions of this show. I'm honored to be on the 200th one.
Thank you very much. Well, I wanted to do something special, and I really enjoyed that, because we covered, like I say, the sacred and the temporal, and the micro economies here, and right the way out to the sun. It really is like what I like to do with the show whenever possible. So, and it's excellent. I'd thoroughly recommend your books. And you're at gregorysams.com, aren't you?
That's right. Gregorysams.com. Links to all sorts of stuff there.
Excellent, and I think there's a PDF version of your book there, isn't there, for the price of a cup of tea or something?
I think it's about two. No, it's on Kindle and on digital versions for about a couple of quid. But the hard copy is obviously available too.
well worth it. I should be getting a few more because I intend to lend them to people and they don't always come back, you know, that sort of book. So, brilliant. Thanks for all the work you're doing. Thanks for joining us on the show, and I'll stay in touch with you on the Skype, sir.
Okay, thanks for having me.
No problem. Thanks for being there. I'll speak again soon. Cheery byes, Greg. So, that was Greg Sams talking to me about all manner of stuff. There were so many subjects we went into there that could actually have been a discussion for a whole radio show on their own. The books, The State is Out of Date, We Can Do It Better, and The Son of God, Discover the Self-Organizing Consciousness That Underlies Everything, are really, really readable. He's funny as well, you know, he does put in these sentences that really lighten the whole thing. And that, I think, is one of the most fundamentally important things about Greg Sams' two books, is that what they do is they actually describe things as they are in non-judgmental language. He's obviously not angry or conspiracy-minded or anything like that. And in my opinion, they're far less likely as a result to kind of draw down the slide response of people who, you know, obviously the people who just don't want to know, don't want to know. But the people who've actually spotted the rabbit hole and are a bit interested in knowing what it is, then I'd say The State is Out of Date is a really brilliant measured introduction. And although he says he doesn't seek solutions, there are some suggestions on the way through. And basically the whole drive of the thing, we never managed, for example, to get seriously into his love of chaos and the fact that order arises, just in natural systems, order arises, and that's all we need to rely on. That is a very exciting idea. And that is the strand that holds the two books together, if you like, that instead of having top-down government, which clearly doesn't work in so many ways, you know, ignoring for the moment the fact that it's working really, really well as it's supposed to, that actually human beings are really, really good at coming up with solutions that fill given niches, and that the very activity of doing that attracts different people who are going to be able to fulfill the next need or niche that arises. And that at this time, when time seems to be travelling so quickly, when it appears there's only about 16 hours in a 24-hour day or something, being able to come up with speedy and versatile solutions is not only desirable, it's absolutely crucial. I mean, it's like, got to be 20 or 30 years ago that I was reading a management book called Thriving on Chaos, which was saying that people needed to be able to make decisions as they passed each other in the corridor because there was no longer time for meetings and things like that. Well, if it's true for business, it's true for us out here as well. And so actually looking to each other for solutions and ceasing to look to government and other people is really the only way to go, taking responsibility. Like that quote said in the book, liberty means responsibility. That is why most men dread it, it says, and that's George Bernard Shaw. Responsibility is what it's down for. You might have noticed that we've run a little bit over 11 o'clock. That's because Freeman Jack is off messing about on the river somewhere. So I'm going to hang around for a while and play some tunes. Well, we'll stick on Andy Hickey and the Merry Maidens and Universal Mind. Because, of course, the ideas that Greg was discussing to do with, you know, our synapses and then the sun and all of that, if it applies to the sun and the sun is genuine, sentient, conscious entity communicating with everything around it, then it's probably true that the whole of the universe is an even bigger one of those. So here's Andy Hickey and Universal Mind, a lovely lyric, not very rocky, but hey, it looks like I'm losing the stream.